Hi there, welcome back. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, and I hope you're having a good day today as the insane asylum of the Milky Way continues to spin out of control. We continue to investigate extraordinary claims and stories that we find interesting and valuable enough to dig deeper into. We listen and learn as we ask questions in an effort to reveal both inconsistencies and accuracy. We hope that everyone contemplates and take nothing at face value, compare it to other information, corroborate, and don't fall into the trap of confirmation bias. Keep moving and keep questioning. This is how we manage to identify the artificial constructs. Some stories you might like, others you might not. Nonetheless, we cast a wide net, and we have a lot of different topics for you, a lot of different opinions and areas on our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Today we're talking with David Livingstone. He has been researching the hidden aspects of history for the last 25 years, resulting in the writing of 3 books. David's approach to history is to dare to consider those areas often dismissed by scholars as the subject of cranks, but to investigate these matters with the utmost scholarly rigor. The results are works that expose many neglected areas of history but resist the temptation to hasty generalizations and therefore offer a more sober, penetrating treatment. Welcome, David. Thank you for coming on the program again. We did a great couple of shows back in 2009 with you, so it's great to have you back again. And of course, it's a delight to know that you've been keeping up your work, David.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Last time we talked about your book, The Dying God, the hidden history of Western civilization, and also Terrorism and Illuminati, a 3,000-year history. Two, of course, huge books on the subjects that combs through a lot of occult and esoteric history of Western civilization and the groups behind them and everything else. And of course, now today, then, we're going to talk about your new book, Black Terror, White Soldiers, Islam, Fascism, and the New Age. And of course, you have, I think those three topics in itself are really important, really interesting. We're going to kind of break that down. Before we do that, however, I would like to get a little bit of time in to talk about the latest Syria crisis. I don't know how much you followed the news, etc., David. I know you're a historian primarily in that sense, but what can you say about Syria, though, if we look at that from the long-term plan? It seems at the moment, though, that this is pretty interesting when we had the offer from Russia to come in and actually handle these weapons for Syria, which might thwart the whole situation. What do you make of it when you look at this?
Yeah, like you said, I'm a historian, so when it comes to everyday details, I'm not always the best person to ask. So I'm more of an overall picture analyst. And I do cover it in my book, though, and I wrote an article recently about it. When it's in my book, it has to do with the Arab Spring and the myth of the Arab Spring and how it's been basically how the U.S. has been using the Muslim Brotherhood to present this as some kind of Islamic uprising. It's not presented to the West as an Islamic uprising, but it's presented to a lot of Muslims as an Islamic uprising. And so Syria is just basically just another domino in this entire chain of events. And what I point out in my book, or in the article as well, is that all this was outlined in 1996 in a document called Clean Break, which was written for Benjamin Netanyahu with the assistance of Richard Perle, whose nickname is the Prince of Darkness, which says it all.
That's nice.
He must be a lovely guy to hang
out. Yeah.
And, you know, all this is long. I also quote a number of people, Michael Ledeen in particular, but all these things have been talked about. I also posted the video. This, probably most people know this one, of Wesley Clark, who was shocked to be told, I think, just before they invaded Iraq, that the plan wasn't just to invade Iraq, but a whole slew of countries, including, I think, even Somalia, Mali, I hope I'm getting that right, and eventually Iran. So all this talk of chemical weapons, obviously, is just a smokescreen to disguise what is actually Israeli foreign policy, which is being carried out by the U.S.
Do you think that Assad was set up basically when it comes to this chemical attack? He talked with Charlie Rose, U.S. media outlet, and basically, try to explain himself. And following up from that, Germany said that they had also done an investigation and found no evidence of it. And now, of course, Russia is stepping in and trying to say, you know, that we'll take care of the situation and seem to kind of, you know, disarm the whole build-up here in a way. So what do you think that means? Is this putting a stick in the wheel for the elite plans of the takeover of Syria, and maybe they won't be able to do it the way they thought they would?
No, I don't think so. I don't know who made the quote, said something to the effect that if you hear about it, it's because they want you to hear about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't know. I don't trust any of these charades. I don't put any confidence in Putin's supposed opposition to what's happening. I think it's all part of the game they're playing. You know, the strange thing is that obviously the Assad family, like pretty much any other rulers in the Middle East, were installed by the West. The Assad family in particular are part of the Alawi sect. It's a Shia sect, and it's a very small minority. I think there's a little less 10%, but they entirely run the country. And the strange thing is that the Alawi sect have a prominent role in the occult, particularly of the occult history of the last 150 years. So I wonder why they're installed. You know, they were very convenient partners until very recently. They were handling renditions on behalf of the CIA only up until, you know, within the last 10 years. So this supposed opposition to the West right now, it doesn't really make any sense to me, but I don't really try to make sense of it, because it's obvious what the longer term picture is, that this is part of a reorganization that they're trying to do. And as I said, really, Israeli plans for the Middle East. So one way or the other, that's what's going to transpire.
Well, that's a very interesting take on it. I have not heard about the Alawi sect of the Assad family. We've seen this, of course, in other countries around the region. Of course, Saddam people will know about. But, you know, in other regards, it seems to be that they, certain leaders are put in place, and they seem to be beneficial for the greater order of things for a while. And either they turn maybe against their masters, if you will, or those who put them in place there, or they just decide that it's time for them to go and something else to happen. I mean, similar in Egypt, Libya, etc.
Yeah, all of them. You know, they all worked hand in hand. I mean, Gaddafi did for, you know, it was very popular for a while there to circulate all the wonderful things he did for his country, but you know, nothing about his ties to Freemasonry, nothing about his assistance with the CIA and all kinds of dirty stuff, you know. So I can't really explain how these things happen, but I think it's kind of like watching the internal politics of the mafia, you know.
Yeah.
It's not really a very ethical organization. So we can't really expect them to operate on any kind of, you know, reasonable principles.
That's very interesting. So you don't know basically if this is an internal fight at the end of it, though, or if they've just decided to oust Assad for some unknown reason to him at this point.
Yeah, I can't explain it.
Yeah. Wow, interesting. Well, what if we talk a little bit about Arab Spring then? And I want to get into Islam and everything else here and kind of get your take on what's been going on in the world here since, primarily since 9/11, of course, in 2001, but also before that point of how this has been now built up, if you will, as the new enemy for the next century or whatever they actually have planned for this. What do you make of Arab Spring and everything that the West heard about this versus what you know and how this is portrayed as internally in many of these countries that were subjected to Arab Spring?
Again, this is a subject I deal with briefly in my book, and I cover mostly the lead up to it to make sense of it overall. As for the details, I don't have a lot, but it's pretty obviously, as I said, it's entirely orchestrated. You know, the people to read on this subject are particularly William Engdahl and his Creative Destruction articles. There's a great article in The Guardian. I can't remember the details. So I'll quote, the name of the author. But it just shows especially all the think tanks that are involved. As Engdahl shows that this was apparently kind of an adjustment to their strategy, as opposed to preemptive action that the neoconservatives were using. Their new tactic now was to use the pretext of the spread of democracy. So everything seems to be done with all these various think tanks that are associated with the RAND Corporation, and then of course in collaboration with the Muslim Brotherhood and other organizations of its kind. So
yep.
I don't have, there's details in my book, but I don't have them at the top of my head to give you a lot of details, but that's the overall picture.
Now, let's try to describe a little bit of this for maybe some of our listeners that aren't familiar about this when we're talking about Islam and the different factions. And I mean, this is, you know, equally as it is within, you know, Christianity or the Western world, there are different interests, there are different ideologies, different theological perspectives, what have you. But I mean, some of the bigger ones that people will know about is the Shia and the Sunni, you know, kind of situation that have been unfolding. And but on top of this, you've also showed that there's many other layers. We have, for example, the Salafim, which is a more of an occult thing. You have Sufism and everything else. How would you deconstruct this for someone who's very unfamiliar with what all these different groups mean, David?
Well, basically, you know, the perception of Islam, of course, is not a very positive one these days. That's no accident. It's part of the propaganda that's deliberately being disseminated to promote their so-called clash of civilizations. But there's no context for people to understand what's happening. And the thing is that if people want to understand what Islam is, what it's been capable of in the past, then they need to look at past empires. Because it would be like looking at Italy today to understand the Roman Empire, or looking at Greece today to understand ancient Greece. So you can't look at the Islamic world today as an example of Islamic civilization. And what happened is that through various other scheming, which we can talk about at some point because it's very relevant, that the Ottoman Empire, which had lasted for almost 600 years, 500 years, collapsed in 1924. And, you know, the amazing thing is that the Ottoman Empire is almost entirely omitted from most, you know, common history books. It's not a history that we hear about. When we hear the Middle Ages, all we ever hear about is Europe. And our impression is that, you know, essentially nothing was happening elsewhere. When the contrary is true, it's actually the Ottoman Empire was the most powerful empire in the world for much of the, you know, sort of late Middle Ages. And so the examples of that civilization, you know, despite errors, because they're human beings like anybody else, but they're what they're able to construct is a more telling example of the truth of what Islam stands for and is capable of. What happens is that when you have no ruling power to defend, you know, basically Islamic orthodoxy, then what happens is they get all the upstarts that are able to come up and undeterred. So this is why the British essentially brought about the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. The main reason was to free up the land of Palestine. But what they did is that they, beyond the Ottoman Empire, what they wanted to do was manage the Islamic world by keeping it, by, you know, according to their divide and conquer strategy of keeping it fragmented. But the most important thing that they did was to create, if I can jump ahead about half a century.
Sure.
What they needed to do, eventually what they wanted to do was create this clash of civilizations. So now that the Islamic world is basically, there is no Islamic world. There's parts of the world with Muslims in it, but there's no Islamic country, there's no Islamic empire. There's no way for the Muslims to kind of gather and make a decision together and, you know, decide on a strategy or anything like that. So if they want to create this pretext of a war against Islam, a clash of civilizations, it's impossible because there's no way to mobilize the Muslims. So the only way they could do it was by creating factions within Islam who would call for what they say is jihad, but basically misusing what they're called jihad is actually violence. It's not really jihad. And but by doing so, and by targeting the West, targeting Israel, and all this talk that they, you know, spew forth, then the West is able to say, we've got this dangerous threat out there and we have to do something about it. That's kind of the overall picture. But, you know, for most of the century, the Muslim Brotherhood has always acted as a tool for various aspects of of American foreign policy in the Middle East, mostly since World War II to fight communism. And then, of course, in Afghanistan. But then we get into the other aspect of the role of these organizations and whatever it is that they are doing on, you know, outwardly or what they appear to be doing. Behind the scenes, they share an occult tradition, which is very deeply embedded with the European tradition. And this is where it gets particularly interesting.
So many points here, of course, we want to try to describe and talk more about. So the Muslim Brotherhood, they're formed in 1928. I mean, I suspect that would be like other organizations too, that they still were maybe around, you know, prior to this period before they actually were formed. But
yeah.
It feels to me as well then, David, that, you know, when I think it was Kissinger who basically said, you know, who do I call if I want to talk to Europe, right? You know, they have this idea of bringing together bigger chunks of land under one, you know, common, you know, law system and everything else.
Right.
Is any of this that's been going on, in your opinion, an attempt to, I mean, right now it's about eroding, you know, what is termed that the undesirables that they don't want to have in there. But eventually, do you think that this is about creating a new kind of unified Islamic world at the end of this? What do you think?
In some way, yes, that's right. It's what is called a neo-caliphate. And that's that essentially was the purpose of the Muslim Brotherhood. It was a puppet caliphate to serve British interests. This was a plot that was outlined by at least two people, Wilfred Scallon Blunt, who was the intelligence agent who was the handler of Jamal Afghani, the founder of Salafism, and again by Lawrence of Arabia. So the idea is that, you know, beyond the Ottoman Empire, they would need to create a neo-caliphate that would be able to serve the British interests. But what seems to be happening now, and, you know, this is the World War III scenario that was that, according to William Guy Carr, was predicted by Albert Pike, and you know, this concept has supposedly been discredited, but
right,
it's hard to explain. But the part that was discredited, it wasn't this part; it was in the other part that he was talking about, which, yes, you know, was mistakenly attributed to a book in the British Museum and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But the part where he described the World War III scenario, that he was paraphrasing from something else. Now, the problem with Carr is that he never provides any footnotes, almost anything he says.
Unfortunately not, yeah.
It's a shame. But, you know, the thing is, for having been written in 1954, it's astoundingly astute. I don't think anybody was predicting a global war with Islam in those days. But that's what's happening. This is what the neoconservatives have been building up to since the early 90s by drumming up this idea of a clash of civilizations. So what they basically, it's a World War III scenario where, you know, I don't know the details, but approximately what seems to be happening is they want to create a war between the Islamic world and Israel, as a pretext to, you know, some kind of, apparently to bring in a new world order. I'm not sure how that's going to take place, but somewhere there, about there, that's approximately what they're doing. So I think that's really the overall picture. To understand what's happening in Syria, that's it's essentially this kind of maneuvering to kind of, you know, the fascinating thing is that according to Islamic traditions, the Antichrist will emerge from Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
Syria. And the bizarre thing is that this is what there's another author, I think it's Philip Johnson. K. Paul Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
He's the author who wrote all the books about Blavatsky's Ascended Masters. Well, most of her masters included the people who are responsible for the birth of the Muslim Brotherhood. Afghani is one of them. Another important one is Abdul Qadir al-Jazairi. And if we talk about Sinicism, this is going to be essential to talk about him. He was a Freemason. He was a Sufi. He was the leader of all these Sufi sects that basically became very important. But to make a long story short, apparently what Johnson suggests is that the reason he established himself in Damascus was because That's where the Antichrist was predicted to emerge from. And the thing is from that time, from the time that he's installed there, been installed there, Damascus has continued to be the bastion of that type of Sufi tradition in the Islamic world, specifically the Naqshbandi Sufis and some of the other Sufi brands. So I think that kind of plays into this, you know, possibly the importance of Syria and these maneuverings.
And this is something they, you know, I guess whether, you know, one believes in these prophecies or not, it seems like they want to try to conveniently use it, you know, play on this, if you will. Yeah,
that's right. It's not that, yeah, it's not that we need to believe it. That's the important thing to understand is they believe it.
Right.
It's the Book of Revelations, you know. The things are coming true from the Book of Revelations because they're following them.
That's right. Yeah, that's always what I've kind of said about this as well. And of course, that doesn't take away that there might be a supernatural, you know, kind of layer on top of this. But nonetheless, it seems that it's being followed more or less like a blueprint and play on this religiosity that they've, you know, set up for such a long time. Now, you know, as you explained, any empire, you know, from the Roman and previous times to the ones that we have today, they always need an enemy to keep both the justification for the empire, but also to keep them, you know, in tight control, you know, in lockstep, if you will. This boosts morale, and, you know, we know all the psychology behind this. But
that's right.
They've turned on the knobs here after 9/11, obviously on the Muslims and everything else. What I've always been curious as well about, David, is that there seems to be a lot of people in the Muslim world, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but they are willing to kind of play ball in how they are being used, if you know what I'm getting at. And I wonder why that is in some cases. Why, you know, just as we talked about Assad previously, they might be in a position where they feel that they can be kind of, you know, on top of their hierarchy for a while. They know what the risks are, perhaps, but they nonetheless, they decide to take the chance, I guess. But describe that a little bit for us, how you see it in terms of the Muslim world and why
there's like becoming, you know, falling into fundamentalism and terrorism and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. If there is a play on that, if you will, because I mean, we talked with William Engdahl about that too, and there is a number of people kind of involved in that process. But yeah, let's get into that.
I think that's easy to explain. Basically, you know, if to truly understand Islam would mean that you have to oppose injustice. So, you know, and this is all clear in all the teachings of Islam. So basically, to be a truly Muslim, you should be fighting, you know, the kind of poverty that's happening in the world, the practices of the World Bank, the treachery of Israel, its collaboration with the US, all these things. And the problem is that, and this is kind of the game I think that's been played, is that when you look at what they've done in Saudi Arabia, they have actually created the antithesis of this kind of Islam, where they say, no, politics is a side issue. The more important thing is to fast and pray and, you know, those kind of things. And so what happens is you get this kind of, a schizophrenia in the Islamic world, you know, like
right.
A disconnect because...
And by the way, keep that thought, but just as there has been within Christian and the Western world, same thing.
It's precisely the same. It's always been the issue. It's always a matter of misrepresenting the religion. And that always happens when people who are not sincere take over the leadership, because then they're no longer preaching justice. They need to start preaching dogma.
Yeah.
And this is what happens. Then the religion becomes dogma. The religion becomes, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, you know, when people are dying and starving everywhere. So what happens is that you get this completely diluted version of Islam, which is all funded by Saudi Arabia. So if you go in all the mosques, you know, most of the mosques in Europe, most of the mosques in America, they're just talking a whole lot of rubbish, you know, really a lot of boring stuff about, you know, the attributes of heaven and hell and, you know, the benefits of fasting and, you know, never anything substantial. If ever you want to start discussing politics, they get all embarrassed and shy, you know, because they don't want to seem unpatriotic. And so what happens is that for those majority of Muslims who see that there's something wrong with that, that they feel inside that they, you know, troubled by the injustice that they see, there tends to be one tiny little group in the Islamic world that is speaking out against it.
Yeah.
Right. And those groups tend to be groups like Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, and they seem to have the courage to oppose all the things that are happening in the world. And then, you know, they will use verses from the Quran. They're very clear. They're black and white. You know, fight the enemy, you know, fight injustice, things like that, except they'll make the excuse that, you know, you need to blow yourself up in a supermarket or, you know, fight in Afghanistan or, you know, on behalf of the CIA. And I think that's fundamentally how it's, I think it's really just that simple how it's being manipulated. So it's a real struggle there. What has to happen is that, you know, it's two sides of a coin, and basically in the middle is the true message of Islam, which has been buried. And what's happening is both camps are feeding a very negative image of Islam, which then again is feeding into the clash of civilizations.
Yeah, the both sides of this conflict that we see right now are both, you know, two groups are equally buying this lie that has been sold to them by the central head of the beast, if you will, and at the same time, then it's understandable. Let's say, and we have examples from this in Europe, you know, David, when you see, you know, Muslim riots in Malmö, you know, down in southern Sweden, you have the call for Sharia law out on the streets in Holland and the UK, and if that's all you see from the point of view of a European and never been to the Arabic world or anything like that, then that's how you're going to perceive it, right?
Common sense conclusion. It's good, but it's propaganda.
Who is in control of those groups? Is it the same? Is it the Muslim Brotherhood? Is it, I mean, it's not Al-Qaeda, I would guess, but are there minor groups, kind of subsets to this structure that you've been talking about?
It's almost entirely Wahhabi from Saudi Arabia and its Muslim Brotherhood, which is basically just a derivation of it, or Salafis. The Wahhabis don't call themselves Wahhabis. They mainly call themselves Salafis. It's almost entirely them. You know, a fascinating story is if you look at the controversy in India, if you look at the Muslim situation there, it's just deplorable. It brings a tear to your eye. It's just such a mess. And just one group after the other, you know, denouncing themselves as unbelievers and, you know, bickering about every tiny little detail. But then the reality of it is, if you look at that, India used to be the most important colony of the British, and this is all a direct result of, you know, typical divide and conquer British strategy, and it's tragic. And most of the modern groups, especially groups like the Deobandis, who were largely used to manage the madrasas that educated the Taliban, have a long-standing relationship with the Wahhabis, and were entirely, all those madrasas were entirely funded by Saudi Arabia. So, you know, they might have different splinter groups, but they tend to be all funded from the same source, which is basically the Rockefeller Foundation ultimately. And it really comes down to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Is there something more you can detail about that connection right there? Because that's a very important and interesting one, obviously, leading back to the Rockefellers.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear, right? It's the whole strategy to destroy the Ottoman Empire was to pit Arabs against Turks. So, you know, they used to be Muslim and Muslim, and the British told them, no, you're Turkish Muslim and Arab Muslim. And so, you know, Turkish Muslims aren't as good as Arab Muslims, so you should fight them. And they did. So the Arabs, when was the so-called Arab revolt, there's two sides of it. They got Sharif Hussein to fight against the Ottoman Empire, and he conquered, you know, Palestine, and they made him king of Iraq. But then
when is this, David? What time approximately?
World War One.
Okay, yeah.
Basically, that's how the British managed to seize the Middle East. Behind his back, they promised him, yeah, sure, help us out, and we're going to make you king of the Arabs to replace the Ottoman Empire. So fantastic, he joined in. But then behind his back, they signed the Sykes-Picot Agreement and took everything away from him except King of Iraq. So, you know, and they even took away Saudi or Arabia and Mecca, which he had, because he used to be the Sharif of Mecca, and they gave it instead to the Saud family, who were longstanding agents of the British. And this is the whole story, I don't know if you remember, that I discovered in my last book, that the Wahhabi sect was created in the mid-1700s by a British agent and in collaboration with the Saudi family. And they were initially suppressed, but they were finally installed in 1932 by the British, with British assistance. So a year later is when the Saudis signed away oil concessions to Rockefeller Standard Oil. And, you know, as they say, the rest is history. You look at the revenue, basically, the Saudi Arabia is the only state in the world that's named after a family. It's the place is pretty much their private property. And 99% of the country's revenue comes from oil. And then that oil is largely, you know, it's supposed to have been handed over to Aramco, but that's kind of a sham. And really behind there is ExxonMobil, which is the newest manifestation of the Rockefeller Empire. So you can imagine there's nothing that Saudi Arabia does that the Rockefellers aren't aware of. On the contrary, everything they do is at their behest. Saudi Arabia was essentially created to protect Israel.
Interesting. Now, what do you make of the, I mean, during Arab Spring, then, you know, Tunisian Revolution, there was a Saudi Arabian protest as well. Again, if we have the opposition, if you will, on the throne of Saudi Arabia, and then you have, was there another opposition that were trying to, you know, deset this? This, I guess, is also why it didn't go further in Saudi Arabia. They actually managed to quell those protests, right?
Yeah, you know, the thing is those protests are all manufactured. So if, you know, if they're spontaneous, they don't get any much backing, so they don't succeed. If they succeed, it's because they've received enough backing. So the revolution succeeded in Egypt, but they don't succeed in Saudi Arabia. You know, it's not because the sentiments are any different.
Exactly. No, that's it's an interesting point of how that played out. And I heard as well other cases that there were, you know, real suppression, if you will, by the Saudi government against their people. But in that case, none of the other countries that were, you know, involved in, you know, bad mouthing and then later invading Libya, for example, didn't do anything in this case, you know. So that was all fine and dandy.
You know, I wrote a fascinating article a couple of years ago. The Americans discovered intelligence documents in Iraq after the war. And this was a document that detailed, you know, I am so thankful for them for translating this document. It's fantastic. This document details the ongoing historical collaboration with the state of Saudi Arabia, and also the numerous claims of the Jewish ancestry of the Saudi family.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, there's tidbits of this in English, but most of these books are Arabic writers and researchers, and these are kind of materials that haven't been translated in English. But thanks to the CIA, they did translate it and made it available. So there's numerous, and you know, so I was already aware of some of them, but from this document, I learned even more claims, and specifically, they tie the Saudi family to the Sabbateans.
Oh.
And that really, really opens up a whole new picture of what's going on. You know, in fact, Wayne Marston? He wrote a great article a couple of years ago on the Domini of Turkey, and he suggested, like, you know, we need to consider now what's the substance of the relationship, these pseudo-Islamic relationships with some of these countries, particularly Saudi Arabia. You know, and if they're Sabbatean, then I think that says it all. It explains their essentially tacit allegiance to Israel.
Ah, interesting. Now, okay, let's want to get into the Sabbatean cult and everything else. We talked earlier, though, about this Salafi cult as well, and that comes out from out of the Sunni branch, right? Correct?
Yes. You know, that's to understand the Salafism, you have to understand Sabbateans as well.
So they're all related in a way.
Yes, it's a Rosicrucian tradition, and the Rosicrucian tradition is a Sabbatean tradition.
I see. Now let's talk. Yeah, let's describe that and break that down for people who don't know.
Well, this is where it gets really interesting, and this is what I found out in my latest book, which, you know, just blew me away, frankly. What happens is that you have this myth of Christian Rosenkreutz, who apparently in the 13th, 14th century traveled to the Middle East and studied Sufism and Kabbalah, and then comes back to Germany and establishes the Rosicrucian order. And there's obvious links between the contents, the kind of Kabbalah of Rosicrucianism, and the Lurianic Kabbalah of Isaac Luria. It's hard to know how many details to get into, but it's influenced by Jacob Burma, and he was also influenced by Luria Kabbalah. His mentor actually had gone to Palestine to study with Isaac Luria's students. That's, I'm just trying to give you an overall picture of that,
yeah,
connection between Rosicrucianism and Kabbalah.
Yeah.
So the Rosicrucians basically announced themselves, I think, in 1519, somewhere around there, 14. And then they're crushed. Their hope was that they would create a Protestant revolution in Germany and that they would get the assistance of King James. But the whole movement kind of failed, and it started the 30 Years' War, and they were completely routed and defeated by the Catholics. What happens is that then many of them went to different parts of the world, particularly England, and that's where they established Freemasonry. But what they were active doing in England in particular was fanning this concept. They're called millenarians, and they were all preaching this kind of end time scenario, and they believed, they almost unanimously believed that the year 1666 was going to be the pivotal year. And they believed that, the lost tribes were going to emerge from Asia, that the Jews were going to be reunited, and this is why Manasseh ben Israel, who was a key character in this entire mission, if not the leader of the whole thing, he's the one who arranged, he began discussions with the government of England to reallow entry of the Jews into England. And they seem to have collaborated, funded Cromwell to take over the country. And once he did finally change the rules to allow the Jews to return to Israel. And pretty much the rest is history after that, because that's when the Bank of England is created, so on and so forth. But to get back to the point, so they're all preaching of this importance of the year 1666. So sure enough, in 1666, Sabbatai Zevi announces himself the Jewish Messiah. And who are the people who are now promoting this as truth, and sort of fanning the hysteria and following it and building up his following, are people who are all tied to these Rosicrucian circles. So obviously the Rosicrucians manufactured or orchestrated the rise of Sabbatai Zevi. And, I don't know how familiar people are with this story, but as I've said before, Sabbatai Zevi declares himself Messiah, but he converts to Islam. Mm. This was a huge event in the Jewish world. This established that approximately half of the world's Jewish population accepted him as the Messiah, but they were hugely disappointed when he converted to Islam. But some of them followed him, looking at it as a mystery, and converted to Islam while remaining secret Jews. And those are the people who are called Domini. And their counterparts in Europe are called Sabbateans or Sabbateans. And it was Jacob Frank. First, he goes to Turkey to communicate with the Domine there, and then he comes back and declares himself the reincarnation of Sabbatai Zevi and starts the Frankists, who in league with the Rothschilds, who according to Rabbi Antelman are also Sabbateans, and then found the Illuminati.
Hmm. What a path. Yeah.
Yeah. So where it gets really, it's hard to keep this simple, frankly.
Yeah.
But I can't explain the whole picture without going into the detail that I'm going to explain.
Sure.
So basically, now it continues to be, the Rosicrucian legend continues to be the core of the mythology that they're using. The Rosicrucian legend is that there had survived groups of Gnostics in Egypt who maintained the traditions of Hermeticism. And that during the Crusades, they came into contact with the Templars, who then brought these traditions to Scotland. And that's the origin of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. Now we have to ask ourselves, who are these people who supposedly came into contact in Egypt? And there's numerous associations, but what it comes down to is a group, an Islamic occult order called the Brethren of Sincerity. And this was a Shia group, Ismaili influenced, Sabian influenced. So they basically kind of brought in all the important occult influences of the Islamic world, and they exemplified them. And they were also the origins of most of the Sufi traditions of Islam, and this is why they're important. So now the Sabbateans resurrect this concept, and this is why the first group that they found to succeed the Illuminati are called the Asiatic Brethren, meaning the Brethren of Asia, these Eastern mystics that the Templars had supposedly been in contact with. In other words, the Brethren of Sincerity. And this becomes the basis of the Rosicrucian legend. And so the Asiatic Brethren basically preserved the sex magic teachings of the Sabbateans and the Rosicrucian traditions of the Sabbateans. And they were the ones who were responsible for the emergence of the so-called occult revival and all the major occult secret societies that dominated the period and created the occult basis of the 20th century, particularly the New Age. So like the Golden Dawn in particular is a direct inheritance of the Asiatic Brethren or the Fratres Lucis. They go by different names, maintaining the same Rosicrucian tradition. We also have to get into Martinism, and that's where Synarchism comes in, but that's another branch we can get back to later. So the leader of the Rosicrucians at the time was Edward Bulwer Lytton. And Edward Bulwer Lytton was also one of the chief, he's the kingpin of the occult revival, the most important occultist of the last half of that century. He was also in the Oxford movement with Lord Palmerston of the Palladian Rite, with Benjamin Disraeli. And it was their plot to spread Scottish Rite Freemasonry in the Middle East as part of their strategy to undermine the Ottoman Empire. And, you know, this strategy evolved into everything they're doing. But basically, it's by using the myth that the Templars had come into contact with the Brethren of Sincerity, or the Sufis, and that Freemasonry, the origins of Freemasonry are found in Sufism. This was the pretext that they used to attract Muslims into Freemasonry. Hmm. And this is where the chief person in this strategy was Abdul Qadir al-Jazairi, who I mentioned earlier. He was in this entire network of British agents, which included Blavatsky, included Scowen Blunt, which I mentioned, Lady Jane Digby, and most importantly, Richard Burton, who was an occultist, theosophist, and British agent. And he was also the one who helped spread the myth of the Sufi origins of Freemasonry. So the chief agent of this plan was Jamal Afghani. And Jamal Afghani deliberately referred to himself and his Masonic brothers as, I'll say it in Arabic, Ikhwan al-Safa wa Khulan al-Marwa, which is exactly the name of the Brethren of Sincerity. Hmm. I don't know if you're able to follow the whole thing.
No, I'm with you. Yeah.
Okay. So it's a direct, you know, deliberate reference to the very origin of the Rosicrucian myth, which places it with the Brethren of Sincerity / Asiatic Brethren as a Sufi tradition. So Jamal Afghani then, of course, is the founder of Salafism. His student is Hassan al-Banna, who founds the Muslim Brotherhood. Hassan al-Banna was commissioned to found the Brotherhood by Hitler. And Hitler, the Nazi Party, was an offshoot of the Thule Society, which emerged out of traditions from Blavatsky and Aleister Crowley, which in turn emerged from the Golden Dawn and then back again to Afghani. So you see what I'm saying? So that the Muslim Brotherhood and the Nazis are part of a single occult tradition, which is what I would assume is the reason why Hitler and Hassan al-Banna cooperated, because at the root, they were part of the same tradition, mainly going back to Jamal Afghani, and then overall going all the way back to the to this Rosicrucian legend.
Wow. Now, what do you know about the Brethren of Sincerity and what they were, you know, if there was special, you know, esoteric teachings that they had that kind of attracted people, or, I mean, there's got to have been something that was the pull here for all of these, you know, consequently in history, all these, you know, groups and organizations and people have been drawn to this to try to, you know, figure out what was going on here, basically. What do you know about them?
I would just, you know, to speak bluntly, I would assume they were secret Jews. They, because their teachings were Kabbalistic, they, you know, they openly attributed their the source of their teachings to the Kabbalah and even to the Jews, and because they become highly influential amongst Jewish Kabbalists, so they're simultaneously influential amongst Jewish Kabbalists as well as Sufi orders. And Sufi orders, I presume, for the most part, were also often crypto-Jewish societies. Particularly, there's the Bektashi Sufi order, and if we talk about synarchism and all these other trends, it's the, especially this, the Bektashi Sufi order was dominated by the the Domine of Turkey, the Sabbateans of Turkey. And this is where we get back to the Nazis, because Rudolf von Sabbatendorf, who's the founder of the Thule Society, he starts by becoming a Turkish citizen and studies Kabbalah and alchemy and all and astrology and all these other occult arts with the Domine Freemasons of Turkey and the Bektashi Sufis. So that's the importance of that tradition.
There's also been a very interesting connection between Germany and Turkey, and I mean, even to this day, there's a lot of Turkish, you know, people in Germany.
Right. And that's why there's a very strange link between, yeah, you know, I'm trying to stay out of it. It's so difficult. But there's a very close relationship between the race theories of the Nazis and the race theories, Turkish race theories of the Young Turks, which is called Pan-Turkism, which is, again, based on Bektashi legends and Domine influence.
Interesting. Now, of course, you mentioned that there is a lot of different traditions, although that you hinge the most of this on Judaism or you know, Kabbalah, the teaching of the Kabbalah, basically. But there seems to be all kinds of Eastern mysticism involved in this, Judaism, as I said, but also kind of esoteric Islam, occult Christianity. I mean, is this, it is syncretism there already in the way that they've pulled all these together to form these esoteric and occult orders, correct?
Well, sort of. You know, that's largely a pretext for the argument that they make, which is, maybe we'll get into the subject, and a concept called traditionalism, which is the belief that all religions have their outward manifestations, but they all share a single occult tradition. And it's true in a sense, because almost every Orthodox tradition has an occult tradition, except that it was a corruption of that Orthodox tradition influenced by the same occult tradition, if you follow what I'm saying. So especially if you go all the way back to Hellenistic times, there were many manifestations of Kabbalah. So there was the ancient mysteries, there was Neoplatonism, Hermeticism, Gnosticism. So it confuses people, and many people assume that they're kind of separate traditions, or that to an extent influenced each other, but they're kind of departments of the same field of study. So they are essentially Kabbalah, but they're, you know, the way I describe it is Neoplatonism is the theology of the ancient mysteries, alchemy is the practical magic of the ancient mysteries, things like that. So it's the same thing as, so when you look at Sufism, especially if you look at the influence of the Sabians and the Asiatic Brethren, most of it, for the most part, is the influence of Kabbalah, particularly the Bektashi Sufis. When you look at Gnostic tradition or most occult tradition in the West, particularly the Templars and the Cathars and groups like that, again, it's the it's Kabbalistic influence. Now, you mentioned Buddhism, and this is where it gets very interesting, because, as I said, the Domine are Bektashi Sufis. And the Bektashi Sufis not only follow Kabbalah, but they also follow incorporated Turkish Central Asian shamanism, which they believe is the original religion of the Turks. So their nationalism is based on a return to what they consider the original religion of the Turks. And what happens is that this is how the concept of Pan-Turkism was developed. And the first person to found the tradition of Pan-Turkism was a man named Kosoma de Koros, a Hungarian. And he did this in the 1830s or so. And he set out to go find the origin of the Hungarian people. And he tried to get to Xinjiang, where what he thought was going to be the original location of Shambhala. And so it was his mention of Shambhala which aroused the interest of Blavatsky. And so, you know, for most of her early career, she was focused on the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor. Now, again, this takes us back to that Rosicrucian I was talking about, because that was supposed to be the Egyptian tradition that taught the Templars. So her and she was connected with Afghani and this entire circle of Jazari and all those crew. And so most of it was focused on Egypt and Turkey. But all of a sudden, after founding the Theosophical Society or thereabouts, her focus shifts entirely and she starts highlighting Buddhism as being, you know, the origin, the fount of the ancient wisdom. But this is what people don't understand. And I cover this quite a bit in my book. And there's more articles that do a far better job than I do online about what is the truth of, because it is not Buddhism we're talking about here, it's Tibetan Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And Tibetan Buddhism is not very close to what Buddhism actually really is. It's an amalgamation of some Buddhist tradition, but mostly of Tantra and Central Asian shamanism. So this is why it all ties in together to this Biktashi concept of shamanism as being the origin of the occult tradition, but not any kind of shamanism, not the shamanism of the Native Americans or, you know, Africans or other parts of the world, even the North Europeans, specifically the shamanism of the of Central Asia, and most specifically of the region of Xinjiang in China, which is now the location of Uyghurs called East Turkestan.
And why is that? Why this region?
Well, this is where we ties into Shambhala. So the reason why Blavatsky says that she now chooses Buddhism as being the true source of what she calls the Oriental Kabbalah, a Kabbalah that preceded Rosicrucianism, preceded Jewish Kabbalah, is Tibetan Buddhism specifically, precisely because, in her estimation, it's the purest preservation of Central Asian shamanism, the purest preservation of the traditions of magic. And then you come back to the whole idea of Shambhala, which is, the Shambhala has many associations that are very strange associations, but basically it's supposed to be when Lucifer and his legions were kicked out of heaven. They established a hierarchy in Shambhala, and they go by many different names. The Theosophists called him Sanat Kumara. He's referred to as the king of the world. You know, this is a deliberate reference to the Christian concept of the devil being the prince of this world, and they did that consciously. And then you have all these accounts of Shambhala in places like Agartha, which is related to it, by people like Osendowski, who claim that that there's some kind of underground realm, a hollow earth. And then that brings us back to Edward Bulwer Lytton, who's primarily the person who there's other people, but he's primarily the person who really instigated this interest in a hollow earth and the idea that the people in the hollow earth, remember that this is a Rosicrucian author, and he suggested that these underground supermen had achieved their power through their commanding of the Vril.
That's right.
Takes us back to the real society, which is closely connected to the Thule Society and the Nazis.
Now, it seems to me we're taking a break in a little bit here, David. We have much more to discuss, of course. It's just, you know, there's so many interesting points and facts that you did bring up and mention. How is it, do you think, that they managed to, because it seems that they want to attract many different, you know, people as possible to their ideology. And at the same time, it's a very, very secret ideology where very, very few are kind of allowed into it. And it seems, at least as you're talking about this, that all the knowledge, maybe not all the knowledge, but a majority of the big picture, if you will, have managed to been preserved through different stages and through history and everything else. As far as you know, has there ever been a break, let's say, from one end to another, from this point of where they discovered that, okay, the origin and source of this is probably in you know, Central Asia. It goes back to Shambhala, this idea. And then, you know, they pick up on this research and then it goes from there. And we seem to have a kind of a line going all the way into today, basically. But has that ever been severed as far as you know?
No, I don't think so. It just seems to evolve. And see, the two things, and this is where it gets into the issue of the New Age, because this entire story that I've been telling you becomes the basis of what they want to preach as the New Age. The basic teaching is that man is God. And that's supposedly the ultimate secret of the occult. And then what they're trying to preach is that all the orthodox esoteric religions that are followed by diverse sections of humanity actually share a single esoteric religion. So what they're trying to suggest, and this is basically the strategy of the New Age movement through the collaboration of the UN, is to create this whole interfaith movement and what's called a one world religion movement, which is to unite the world in a single belief that we can all agree, you know, that Muslims and Christians can all get together, Muslims, Christians, Jews, Buddhists, you know, on and on and on, can all get together and agree, because fundamentally our religion is the same, and the basis of that religion is Freemasonry, or more specifically, the occult tradition, or essentially Kabbalah.
Okay, pause right there then, because I have a great follow-up question to that I want to ask you in a second, because obviously what we see in the world today, at least when it comes to Islam in this case, is the complete opposite to that. It's a disassociation, it's a polarization. I think that's very conscious, but I'm going to ask you more about that in a second, David. Let's talk a little bit about where people can get a copy of the book. It's called Black Terror, White Soldiers, Islam, Fascism, and the New Age. Go ahead and give your website, David, and also tell us about some of the other titles that you have available.
Thanks. So you mentioned earlier, my first book is The Dying God, The Hidden History of Civilization. The one after that was Terrorism and the Illuminati. I've also written Surrendering Islam with Mustaquim Blair. And then most recently, my new book, which you just mentioned. So all of them, I keep all my information in my blog and my articles, all my postings are still at my website, which is terrorism-illuminati.com. My book has been uploaded to Google Books if anybody wants to read excerpts of it, if they're interested in taking a look. Otherwise, it's available at all major suppliers like Barnes & Noble, Amazon, special order at a bookstore, and there's also a Kindle version available. If you don't have a Kindle, you can always download the Kindle app, and then you can read it on any device. That's pretty much it.
All right, very good. We're going to have the website up. And again, then Black Terror, White Soldiers, Islam, Fascism, and the New Age. A lot of material, of course, in the book. So do check it out. A lot of things to learn from. Last time we had David on was the same thing, was tons of reference, of course. And you guys have a lot of new names to look into in case you're not familiar with some of this stuff already. So we'll be right back with more.